In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Heavenly Father, thank you for bringing us together tonight. We pray that this evening be an opportunity to grow closer to you, to know better how your church is meant to operate in this world, to know how we are to take the gift of both the church and of science to better explore the universe that you have created for us. Be with us always, our families, our friends, and for those who have no comfort, help us to reach out to them to be comfort for them. We ask this in the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Okay, so the question for the evening is there a conflict between faith and science? Oops. No. All right, see everybody next month. No, there is no conflict. The problem is there are a whole bunch of misconceptions that people have both about the church and about science. And so the purpose of tonight's talk is to walk through a little trouble with my speed of execution there. Okay. Walk through what some of those misconceptions are. First, certain people, and these are all misconceptions, what you're seeing here are all bad things. The first is some people have a limited view of what a rational argument or thought is. They limit the scope of what that could mean. Two, they only see one valid method of investigation or discovery. They don't allow for the possibility there might be more than one way to learn about things. Three, the air of scientism. This isn't scientist or scientists. It is a philosophy called scientism that we will discuss. Fourth, Christian fundamentalism also causes people to have an error on the other side. We'll talk about the Galileo incident. I'm sure you hear about it whenever issues of the church and science come up. We'll talk about the accusation that Catholics limit scientific research, that they are against certain things. And then we'll talk about the difference between evidence and proof, because hiding inside of a lot of arguments is a perspective that assumes one versus the other in an either-or kind of way. So I'd like to start with a quote from Bishop Barron. He actually said this just a handful of days ago, and I thought, wow, this is great, just what I'm looking for. He was in Rome speaking at a synod on the young people. For many people today, science and rational are simply equivalent or coextensive terms. And therefore, since religion is obviously not science, it must be irrational. How many people have kind of heard that line of thinking, right? That it's just, oh, if it's not science, it's not rational thought, therefore I get to dismiss it. Without for a moment denigrating the sciences, we have to show that there are non-scientific and yet eminently rational paths that conduce towards knowledge of the real. Literature, drama, philosophy, the fine arts, all close cousins of religion, not only entertain and delight, they also bear truths that are unavailable in any other way. So we'll dig into this, but there's a lot of what I'm speaking about tonight in this quote. Okay, so let's start with what is rational? What is rationality? And I went straight to the dictionary. This is not Ken's definition. This is what Merriam-Webster has to say. Obviously, for most definitions, they have multiple. I picked the one that's kind of on the right topic. So rational, relating to, based on, or agreeable to reason. Okay, so rational is something that comes from reason. Reason, the power of comprehending, inferring, keyword, or thinking, especially in orderly, rational ways, and it referenced its intelligence. Intelligence, the ability to apply knowledge to think abstractly as measured by objective criteria. Apply knowledge to an abstract thought. This is what reason is. Reason requires a starting point. We know X, Y, and Z, therefore we can come up with a whole new set of conclusions based on X, Y, and Z. All reason starts with some assumption. Whenever I say that to people, their eyes kind of twirk. There must be something that doesn't have a starting assumption. No, it's absolutely impossible. Every single thought we have has some assumption built into it. And one of the lies of those who overpromote science is they make the argument there are no assumptions underlying their perspectives. There are assumptions there, and we'll go over those. So yes, really, everything, every rational, reasoned thought starts with something, your assumption. Now, people can start working their way back, right? We have, okay, I know X, Y, and Z, and I have this conclusion, I like this conclusion, and so I'm going to work my way back from X, Y, and Z and go through each three of those, working back, reason, trying to go back. But you'll never get to a beginning. You'll never get to a point that you can say, aha, I've eliminated all possibility of assumptions. There will always be one. So let's talk about what science is, for specifically the purpose of what are the assumptions of science. Science, again, this is Merriam-Webster speaking, a system of knowledge covering general truths or the operation of general laws, especially as obtained and tested through the scientific method. Right? That's a lot of words just to say. It's the scientific method. What is the scientific method? This is not from Merriam. This is from livescience.com, a science-promoting website. So again, not a Catholic source, just a science source. We make observations. We ask questions about the observations. We gather information. And from those observations, we develop a hypothesis. What's going on here? What's the physical thing that's happening? Then we test our prediction. We test our hypothesis in an experiment that can be reproduced. We analyze the data, draw conclusions about whether the hypothesis is proven or needs to be modified or if more testing is needed. There's a whole process around that. But even then, once we've said, yes, this seems true, we must continue to reproduce it. Time and time again, a theory is never proven unless it can be repeated over and over and over. Basic science. So look at the key words. Observations, predictions, reproducing. There are assumptions that underline those words. First, that our observations are trustworthy. That what we observe is true, right? The Matrix is the classic antidote to this thought, right? What if this is a simulation? Now, none of us here believe it's a simulation, but hopefully, that is an assumption. It is an assumption that this is a real world with real observable things that we can actually notice, that it's not something, that is deluding us in some fashion. We live in an ordered universe. We're looking for something reproducible. That assumes that things have order and rules and perspectives that repeat themselves over and over. And additionally, that order doesn't change over time. F equals MA is going to be F equals MA 1,000 years from now and 1,000 years in the past. That those laws don't change over time. Actually, there's some interesting scientific research around the idea that maybe there are some of these laws that do morph a little bit with time. I mean, so there are certain scientific bents that actually challenge that assumption. But generally speaking, we make that assumption that gravity is what the gravity constant isn't going to change. And then an additional one, this is more of an ancient thing, that God doesn't frequently interfere with this, that he's not so often messing with the puzzle that we can't do valid experiments, right? That most of the time when we knock the ball, God's not going to knock it a different way and mess the experiment up, right? Now, this is an important point. Science doesn't today rely on Christianity, but its source did. These are Judeo-Christian ideas. Pagan ideas did not accept the idea that gods left the world alone. The god of the sun and the god of the moon and the wind and the tides and all of these things were constantly warring with each other and manipulating these processes. They did not assume an ordered world that God set up and mostly let operate. So you wouldn't have science as we think of science today. Science today comes from the worldview that comes from Christianity, that God set the world in motion and for the most part lets those motions continue. Now, people have accepted that now for reasons that don't specifically depend on Christianity, but the point is these are assumptions. These are not provable things. I skip one. No. So if we take the idea that everything has starting assumptions, and so therefore we're not tied to the idea that the only way we could do something is through science, because we could start with different assumptions or different conceptual frameworks and then build up reason on top of that, we could have more than one method of deciding truth. It's not only science. Science isn't the only way we could determine something to be true. And actually, very interesting one of that is mathematics. Did you know you go to about half of colleges? The College of Math is not in the sciences and engineering portion of campus. It's part of the College of Arts. Math, in many ways, shares more in common with philosophy than it does with science. Now, of course, scientists use math. They take math and then use these principles to really help their science. There's no doubt about that. But at its core, science is an abstract philosophical framework of numbers that they build up into these very interesting ideas. So mathematics is not inherently science. It is actually a rational thought process similar to philosophy. And so with philosophy, we take now higher truths of the kind of human mind and say concepts that go beyond just observing the physical world. And then, of course, religion, which is a close cousin of philosophy, goes even further down that road. And we'll talk a little bit about what makes religion religion later. But the point is, all of these are exercise in the use of reason. You start with certain building blocks that not necessarily everyone will agree with. Many of them hopefully can be agreed upon, but are principles that you then use to build additional thoughts on top of that. So, to take mathematics as an example, we say 1 and 1 is 2, and then we know something. We can build on that. That must mean 1 and 2 is 3, and we can start doing things. I'll give you an example of how these things can kind of, you know, bend your mind, right? Can anyone tell me how 1 plus 1 is 10? It's an actual truth. 1 plus 1 can be 10. Yeah, you're counting in base 2. Right? When you count in base 2, which is the number system of computers, the numbers go 0, 1, 10, 11, 20, or excuse me, 100, 101, 110, 111, 1,000. That's how you count in base 2, right? So our assumption when we're talking about math and someone says 1 plus 1, we all assume base 10 by default, unless somebody tells us otherwise, right? Okay, scientism. All of this has kind of been leading up to this. This is, again, the definition from Merriam-Webster. An exaggerated trust in the efficacy of the methods of natural science applied to all areas of investigation. Basically, they're saying all that there is out there is science. We can't use anything else. So when you hear a scientist who makes conclusions beyond their actual research, what they can actually demonstrate, and they are saying these things extending beyond what they could safely say, they are in some ways buying into the idea of scientism, that they assume the only truths come from that, and therefore, anything else is bogus. It is a religion in the sense that it is a belief system. It is a belief system that only answers could come from science. But there are most definitely limits to science. And to give fair credit to lots of scientists out there, when I was researching this talk, I found science-based websites that freely admitted, in fact, I got most of this list from, or at least validated that they agreed with my list, from science websites. So there are plenty of scientists who aren't buying into scientism. But any why question, science can't answer why. It can say how, it can name properties of things, but why the apple exists, it can't answer that question. It can only answer questions of how. That's basically what science is asking. It is a question of how. It also cannot answer anything about what exists outside the observable universe or whether that exists. By the very definition of the scientific method, it must be observable. And so if it's not observable, therefore, they can't speak to it. They can make a religious statement to say, I don't believe anything exists outside of this, and that's all I'm going to allow for. But that is not a scientific conclusion. It is a religious conclusion or a metaphysical conclusion. Because science can physically not answer that question. Is there something outside the observable universe? It can also not prove a miracle, because a miracle, by definition, is some interference with the reproducible scientific world, right? So they can't reproduce a miracle, right? That wouldn't be possible. You can't go back to Fatima and say, okay, how do I make the sun move around again? No, you can't do that. Science can't do that. A caveat it can do is there are moments where it can disprove a false miracle. It can take something where somebody fabricated a miracle, intentionally or not, but fabricated a miracle, and science could say, look, this is how it was fabricated. So that science could disprove a miracle, but it can never prove either that they don't exist or that a particular one was true or not true, minus, you know, something that's demonstrably a fraud. By the way, this is one that really get the kind of atheistic scientists worked up. We have a lot more freedom when it comes to miracles. If someone says to me, hey, here's Mary in my grilled cheese sandwich, right? Wasn't that one 10, 15 years ago? We're free to say, yeah, we don't think so, right? We can say no to any particular claim of a miracle. That doesn't hurt our faith. Somebody faked a miracle. Okay, that's a fake. That's a fake. That's a fake. That's a fake. A scientist, an atheistic scientist, one who believes nothing exists outside the physical world, can never allow for any miracle, any single miracle, blows apart their worldview. So they are actually far more closed-minded when it comes to investigating a miracle. They already have what they want the answer to be in their mind. It must be fake. And they will keep digging and digging and digging and digging, trying to do the one thing they can do, which is disprove it. But if they can't do that, they still believe and are going to keep trying. We don't need to do that, right? We can say, oh, well, that one was a fake. Fooled me for 10 years, but not anymore. There are other ones we can say, well, looks pretty real. Maybe in a decade we'll find out it wasn't, but looks pretty real for today. We have far more intellectual freedom when it comes to investigating miracles than the atheist does. Another thing, validity of any moral judgment. Science cannot say if it's a bad thing to blow up the earth. They can say what will physically happen and that all mankind will disappear, but why is that bad? Who said we were a good thing? There are people out there who actually argue we're a plague. We're, you know, you hear this every once in a while, like from the environmentalist set that gets overly worked up about environmentalism, right? Humanity is a plague. So wouldn't it be a good thing if we blown up the earth then? That is a moral judgment. That comes from something beyond what science could possibly answer. So the point is, there's definitely limits on science. There are lots of questions it can answer, lots of great questions it can answer, but there are most definitely questions it cannot answer. All right. So that's one set of errors. One set of errors is over here on, I put too much faith in science. I overly build it up. I treat it like a religion. I don't accept its limitations. That's one way people go off the rails. And they try to use science to invalidate our faith. On the other side of the equation, we have the joy that is Christian fundamentalism. These people also miss the mark. And what's very frustrating to me, and part of the reason I wanted to do this talk, is when you go look on your average, you know, newspaper comment board or whatever, the two people who are arguing with each other are the atheist scientists and the fundamentalists, and there between them comes a rational argument. Right? Neither one of them have any clue of the limitations of their argument, and they're just talking by each other, reinforcing their own thoughts because the other one is clearly an idiot. And they're right about that. They're right, but that they don't realize is that they're an idiot too. There's a third answer. Okay, so what is Christian fundamentalism? And the term fundamentalism started here, but has now been used in a more broad sense. We talk about Muslim fundamentalism and stuff like that, but actually the source of the term started with Christianity, was stated in a positive way. In the early 20th century, there were Christian groups that were not happy with the liberalization of Protestant American groups in particular, that were adopting things they weren't happy with, and they said, we need to go back to the fundamentals. We need to go back to the fundamentals of the Bible and believe those fundamentals as true. And they took a very literalist view of the Bible. Everything in the Bible is true, literally and specifically. There's no metaphor. Believe it as it is. They believe in the literal 7 days of creation. They believe literally Adam and Eve existed as Adam and Eve. They believe the literal Eve was made from the literal rib of the literal Adam. They view the first few chapters of Genesis and the rest of the Bible where appropriate, but this is where the heart of it is, as effectively a scientific explanation, a historical scientific explanations of the beginning of the universe. That's the way it happened. God told us so from on high. It's in the Bible. Believe it as it is. The people, and there's gradations of this. I should be a little fair to those who kind of accept some fundamentalism but don't go to the extremes. But the extreme people will say, no, the earth is 6,000 years old because if we do the math, how old Noah was and how old this person was, the earth is 6,000 years old. The reason there are dinosaurs is because God put them there to fake us out. I mean, they go through all of these kind of very extremist explanations to validate Genesis must be true as it is stated. Catholics are not fundamentalist. This is so important. We live in the United States where there are a lot of Christian fundamentalists. We like to be friends with other Christians with good reason. It's good to work with them and share our common Christian faith. That's all wonderful and good, but unfortunately, sometimes it means we start buying into some of their not-so-good ideas. And you see a lot of Christian fundamentalism creeping into various circles of Catholicism. We are not fundamentalist. We understand that the Bible was written in a certain time with a certain purpose, and we should not extend beyond that when we're reading it. Genesis is not intended, nor was ever intended, to be a scientific or historical account of exactly what happened. It is a description of the nature of creation, not the specific order. And see how we're doing on time here. Okay, I have the first chapter of Genesis. We'll read a couple sections of it if you realize how ridiculous it is to read it literalistically once you start diving into it. There were no moments when the writers of Scripture were sitting down saying, I'm trying to explain the way the physical world operates like the way a scientist would. They're always trying to talk about God and our relationship to God. So here's what we take from the first chapter of creation. God is the creator of everything we could imagine. If you think about, and we'll go through it a little bit, if you think about those first few days, it's talking about God creating everything. Light, darkness, earth, moon, sun, the foundations. Remember, this was a pagan world. In the pagan world, you had separate gods. One was the god of the sun. One was the god of the moon. We're saying, no, no, no. Our God is over all that. He did everything. Another is creation is good. Luckily, most of the world, I think, has bought into this idea, but a lot of religions historically have not embraced that idea that creation is good. It's just repetitive. It's beating you over the head. God made it, and it was good. And that God made mankind in His image. These are the key takeaways. There's more detail in there, but that's the heart of what the story is about. So when we hear scientists talk about the creation of the universe, it doesn't threaten us, because that's not what the Bible's trying to say there. We can just say, oh, well, that's interesting. Turns out the universe is a few billion years older than we thought. Oh, okay. Interesting discovery. But we expect scientists to restrict their conclusions to the observable universe, and we also expect them to respect moral limitations. So we don't let scientists go free and start running over our turf, but we do respect them for what they can add to the discussion, which is a lot. Okay, so let's go through Genesis a little bit, and you'll see some of the ridiculousness as we get going. So in the beginning, when God created the heavens and the earth was without form or shape, with darkness over all the abyss and a mighty wind sweeping over the waters, then God said, let there be light, and there was light. God saw that the light was good. God then separated the light from the darkness. He called the light day and the darkness night. Evening came and morning followed, the first day. Then God said, let there be a dome in the middle of the waters to separate one body of water from the other. God made the dome, and it separated the water above the dome from the water below the dome, and so it happened. God called the dome sky, evening came, the morning followed, the second day. Then God said, let the water under the sky be gathered into a single basin so that the dry land may appear. And so it happened. The water under the sky was gathered into its basin and the dry land appeared. God called the dry land earth and the basin the water He called the sea. God saw that it was good. See, He's just starting with such huge fundamental building blocks, right? And He sees that it's good. Then God said, let the earth bring forth all kinds of vegetation, every kind of plant that bears seed, and every kind of fruit tree on the earth that bears fruit with its seed. And so it happened. The earth brought forth vegetation, every kind of plant that bears seed, and every kind of fruit tree that bears fruit with its seed in it. God saw that it was good. Evening came, morning followed, the third day. This is where it starts to get fun from, wait a minute. Then God said, let there be lights in the dome of the sky to separate the day from night. Let them mark the seasons, the days and the years. So the sun was created in the third day. We had light 2 days before. We had day and night. Now we finally have the sun. It just doesn't make any sense if we're treating it as a scientific work, which it's not. God made the two great lights, the greater one to govern the day and the lesser one to govern the night and the stars. God set them in the dome of the sky to illuminate the earth, to govern the day and the night, and to separate the light from the darkness. I thought we already separated the light from the darkness on the first day. God saw that it was good. Evening came and morning followed, the fourth day. A little aside, figuring out that this was ridiculous is not a modern discovery. You go back and you read Jews from before the time of Christ, the church fathers, Augustine, all of these kinds of people, they knew it was ridiculous. But they also knew it wasn't the point. It's only when fundamentalism came around that they started to buy into the ridiculousness. He made a whole bunch more stuff. I don't want to just read everything here. Fifth day, it was good. Creatures made it good. Wild animal, great. Everything's good. Then we get to the key passage about humanity. Then God said, let us make human beings our image after our likeness. Interesting note, our likeness. This was written by Jews who believed in just the Father. They didn't have a sense of the Holy Spirit and the Son, but yet they still used the word plural in Hebrew. Not about tonight's talk, but an interesting thought nevertheless. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, etc. God created mankind in His image. In the image of God, He created them. Male and female, He created them. God blessed them and said to them, be fertile and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it. We're talking about what God, why God made us and what we're here for. Does it matter that it's after all the other animals or anything like that? No, it doesn't. That's not the point. He looked at everything He made and found it good the sixth day. Whoops. And then the seventh day He rested. Kind of like we do. Right? They're trying to explain, why do we have a seven-day week? Why do we do it this way and have a day of rest to the Jewish people? This is why, because God created it this way. So the 7 days are not because it's some literal sense of creation where the sun wasn't created till the third day, and since that what determines how long a day is, it wouldn't make any sense to have 2 days without them. No, that's not relevant. The point is they want to build up this idea that He created for 6 days, like we toil and work for 5 days in the office and 1 day in the backyard, and the seventh day is for rest. So there is great purpose and meaning to Genesis, but it is completely foolish to turn it into a scientific work. It is not. It is a theological, philosophical work of wonderful, great depth. One of my personal little favorite little notes of the genius of Genesis is not in 1, but in chapter 2. When Eve convinces Adam to eat the fruit. It's just said out of hand, no big deal. You would have thought after God told him not to do it, Adam would have been a little bit more reluctant to just, you know. But here's the answer to that question. It very well explains mankind. Because just go on YouTube, search up guys doing stupid things or whatever. And always in the corner is a girl in a bikini, right? He's about to do something stupid. Why? Because the girl's telling him to. It's kind of the nature of humanity. Men do things because girls want them to. It's not the biggest note in all of Genesis, but it's a little truth that's hiding in there. All right. Seventh day. Okay, so we don't read the Bible like fundamentalists do. Well, then what's the story with Galileo? Why is it we were such jerks to Galileo in the 16th century, right? That's always thrown at us. If you guys aren't anti-science, why Galileo? First of all, concession. And this is very obvious in today's world. Who here thinks the church is perfect? Yeah, nobody, right? We make mistakes. We know we make mistakes. So nobody has to claim that, oh yeah, we did things perfectly with Galileo. Yeah, we made some mistakes. But here's the key question. Why Galileo and not Copernicus? Copernicus was alive during the life of Galileo. Galileo's research came from Copernicus. Copernicus was a priest. You'd think if they were all over locking down the evil Galileo, Copernicus would have been censured just as harshly. Because that's where the ideas came from. Galileo was just building on his ideas. And the fundamental answer is that Galileo didn't limit himself to science. He wasn't an atheist, but he did what so many scientific atheists do today. He was this very bombastic, aggressive person, and he would not just let it be a scientific proposition. It had to be true, the church had to accept it as fact, and he was even meddling in the scriptures, talking about how scriptures could be wrong, and got himself in trouble. Now, did the church act perfectly? No, it didn't. It probably should have just patted him on the head and said, please go stand over there. Particularly with how powerful it was in the era. But it got itself all worked up, somewhat inappropriately. But the importance of the matter, it was not just about the science. It was about the individual who was poking and prodding the bear. And the scientists who weren't doing that, like Copernicus and other people in the same era, didn't end up in house arrest for the rest of their life. Did the church get egged into a fight it shouldn't have gotten egged into? Yes. But it wasn't just about science. The other half of the question is, and did I not put this on the next slide? I didn't. Why is it only Galileo? Is this the only example they've got 400 years ago? This is really what we're stuck with? You know, assumably, if this is an institutional thing that we actually are sticking it to all scientists who question the church, the Bible or whatever, we'd have hundreds of examples of this. But they don't. They've got Galileo and then a couple other ones that they really have to stretch. There's not a lot of examples about this, but yet they have to pick on the one that admittedly is their best shot and an example. But it's never as simple as one would make it out. Okay. Oop. This is a problem with using a mouse. Come on. Doesn't want to stop in the middle. All right. Now, another charge leveled against the church. Well, why is it the church wants to stop certain kind of research, like embryonic stem cell research or whatever the hot topic of the day that the church says, you shouldn't be able to do this? Aren't we anti-science because of that? Doesn't that prove we're anti-science? My bullets are a little out of order here. No, because experiments to prove scientific thoughts can be immoral. It's not wrong to want to search the answer to scientific questions, but if you do them in a way that is inappropriate, yes, we should be able to say, no, you can't do that experiment. So if someone says, you know what, I'm really interested about how the human body reacts to radiation. So I'm going to take a couple thousand people, I'm going to go put them on an island, and I'm going to drop a nuclear bomb over them. It'll be a very interesting scientific experiment, right? It will know a heck of a lot more about the human reaction to radiation if we do this. That is a valid scientific experiment. But to be fair to most scientists, they'd recognize, no, that's immoral. We can't just go take people and nuke them to learn more about science. So our saying there are limits to what you can do in your experiments is not because we don't want science. It's because we're saying you still have to follow morality while you're exploring science. You need to find some other way to do your experiment besides violating the dignity of the human person, torturing animals, or anything excessively destructive, right? No, you shouldn't be doing that. That's not good. And yes, why we may have a different view of when life begins and these sorts of things that would, you know, make it so that what we consider violating the human dignity of human life is different than what somebody else might. But still, the fundamentals are still true. We're allowed to say there are moral limits of what's reasonable for scientific testing. That is not interfering with science. It's accepting that there's more going on in life than just science. A little bit of a different point. The conclusions of science can never explicitly have moral implications. I'll give you a theoretical example. Let's assume they did a bunch of research and they found out Asian people have 10 higher IQ points than white people. They're smarter than white people. Could that be scientifically true? I mean, I don't believe it is, but yes, it could theoretically be true. Would we take that and make a moral decision based on that? The church would say, hopefully not. Hopefully the dignity of all human beings mandates that it doesn't matter that they're smarter than us. We're all human beings. We all have equal dignity. So the scientific conclusion shouldn't drive us to make a moral conclusion. Things can be scientifically true without threatening our moral conclusions. And a lot of times people get too afraid here. What if science finds out? You know, like one that actually is a current fear. There's a fear that perhaps Africans, sub-Saharan Africans might have a slightly less intelligence than Western Europeans. The research is inconclusive. I don't mean to suggest that this is actually the truth. But people will get, oh, we shouldn't do that research. It would cause, you know, all these kind of problems. One might argue that it may not be prudent to go down those roads because some people may use that data incorrectly. But at the fundamental level, it doesn't matter. There's no reason that religiously we should be afraid of that being the truth. If anything, it becomes an evangelization moment to say, it's more proof that this idea of the equal dignity of human beings is a religious point. And it's a religious point that hopefully people who don't necessarily buy into our faith can start to see the truth of. That we can't view people just by how smart they are, or how fast they are, or anything like that. Human dignity is inherent. And if we prove that people were more different, but we insisted on treating people the same, it becomes an evangelization tool of a better way of looking at the world. The inverse says, no, everyone has to be the same because we've kind of bound it up in science that everyone must be the same and therefore that's why we all have equal dignity, right? Then it can all collapse. And so it's actually harder in that kind of scientific atheist worldview to defend human dignity if the science ever suggested otherwise, right? Exactly. All right. Let's go a different route. Okay, so we've defended why we're not doing the wrong things. But let's talk about all the right things we're doing. There are hundreds and thousands of scientists who have done wonderful scientific things as priests and friars and monks and all kinds of things. And here's just, you know, kind of a big top list. I love William of Ockham because Occam's razor is so popular with the atheist scientist view, right? The simplest answer must be true, therefore religion is wrong. It was a Catholic guy who came up with the theory. I don't think that it necessarily proves anything. Copernicus, little tree. It takes me 2 seconds to say Copernicus. I always want to start that name wrong. Copernicus, okay. Copernicus, right, discovered heliocentrism, the idea that, no, the earth is going around the sun, not the other way around. Catholic priest, got Galileo built on his work. This one's a little less well known, although the implications of his work are well known. Christopher Clavius is the Jesuit who really drove Pope Gregory the 13th to create the leap year, the idea that we need an extra day, on occasion to keep the year in line with the sun. And how did they find this out? They found it out based on the Vatican Observatory. There's a place inside the Vatican where a little dot, or there used to be anyway, where a little dot on the floor said, you know, what day of the year it was. And they had all these markings and everything. And over the centuries, it slowly got out of whack. It was about 10 days out of whack by this time. And so they said, okay, we installed it in whatever, 412, it's year X, it's moved 10 days. This is how much it's off of 365 days. And this speaks to how great the power of the Catholic Church was in this era. So this guy talks Pope Gregory into, this is a problem, we need to fix it. What we need to do is we need to move the calendar some year, 10 days. And then after that, to get it back on track, to back to how originally should be. And then after that, we need to do this system where every 4 years, except on a century year, we have an extra day. And he talked the Pope into it, and then amazingly, the Pope said, okay, world, do this. And the world did it. Can you imagine that today? The Pope says, okay, from now on, we're calling, you know, February, whatever, Pope month, right? Nobody would care, right? This speaks to how powerful the church was in this era, that they could say, next October, you're just going to skip from the 1st to the 11th. And everybody did it. Gregor Mendel, father of modern genetics, he figured out the whole recessive dominant gene thing. George, I think it's Lemaître, Catholic priest and father of the Big Bang Theory. He's the one who came up with the idea that it came from the research that the universe is expanding. So they kind of did the math, okay, how fast it's expanding, how far do you have to go back till it was all one spot. These are all priests, friars, Jesuits, who scientists doing important scientific work. It's impossible to look at the history of the church and not see science running throughout it. Where people got in trouble was when they then took science and tried to make metaphysical conclusions. Right? Darwin, evolution, we've got no problem with evolution as long as you say that means God doesn't exist. No, we just have to say, this is how God's doing it. This is how God makes it happen. And there's nothing in the science that suggests one way or the other. It is a metaphysical conclusion. Okay. Evidence versus proof. One of the disadvantages we have is science has this benefit of at least pretending, because once we get back to the idea of assumptions and all of that, their proofs aren't so proofy. But conceptually, they have this idea they can prove things, right? And nothing else can. Therefore, we're the only ones that are right, right? This is the only method that we can truly determine things, because it's the only place we can actually prove things. Metaphysics cannot. And that's true. Metaphysics cannot prove. But evidence is still important. Evidence of things is still real. So we don't have to give up rational just because we're relying on unproven evidence. We rely on that all the time, right? I come home, something's happened wrong. I got two kids who are likely candidates for the problem, right? Do I have to prove that it was one of the two of them and not a burglar? No, I can just go, Andrew, who did it? Right? Evidence is important even without proof. And so we can take revelatory evidence, real things that really existed, that there's demonstrable evidence that they happened, add reason to those things, and say, this is our faith. So, that Jesus rose from the dead. There is lots of evidence of this. People who said, I saw him after they put him in the tomb. Do we know he wasn't just in a 3-day coma? No, we don't. But the evidence suggests otherwise. Right? So, do not let the fact that it's not proven deny us that we have evidence for it. Real, concrete, historical, scientific-like, you know, scientifically justifiable evidence. So the conclusion here is, how did I do on my time? Hey, pretty darn good. Science and theology should work in concert with one another. They are different spheres of knowledge. They both are valuable. We don't have to say one or the other. They both can have great aspects of truth. And as Catholics, we are very happy to let scientists be scientists. We are not happy when scientists try to become theologians. That's when we say, wait a minute, you've crossed the line. Movie Contact, one of my favorite. Who's seen this movie? It's a little old now. Couple of hands, right? The story is a story of a woman who's searching for extraterrestrial life, getting thwarted at all phases, eventually discovers it, goes on this journey to them, and is deposited back on Earth without any evidence of her experience. And she's, and I'm sorry, I'm totally giving away the whole movie, so if you go watch, you're like, dang it, Ken, you messed it all up. But at the very end of the movie, the question is, they're trying to get the scientist to admit, you do not have any proof of this, do you? And she eventually concedes the point. You're right, I do not have proof. And it's a very moving speech at the end. But I believe with every fiber of my being, I had this experience, it's real, it's true. And at the end, they ask, there's this kind of counterperson to her that's a person of faith. From a Catholic perspective, you kind of cringe at him, but that's okay. And they ask him, what do you believe happened here? And I loved his answer. He says, as a person of faith, I'm bound by a different covenant than Dr. Arroway. But our goal is one and the same, the pursuit of truth. This is how religion and science should be looking at each other. We are both after truth. We both desire to know what is really true. We should love it when the other comes up with conclusions that we support. That's a wonderful thing. There should not be any animosity here. And it's very unfortunate that we have it. Pope Leo XIII, I'm loving the 13th. We had Gregory XIII, Leo XIII. There can never indeed be any real discrepancy between the theologian and the physicist. As long as each confines himself within his own lines and both are careful, as St. Augustine warns us, do not make rash assertions or to assert what is not known as known. Pope Leo XIII is quite a while ago. He's a 19th century, 18th century, but is ways back. And by the way, St. Augustine was more or less speaking to the same kind of stuff. Science didn't exist back then as it does today, but was more or less talking about the same kind of issues. This is where we should be. We should be at this idea that these are both wonderful ways to pursue truth. And there's no reason we should be afraid of the other as long as we recognize what are the bounds and limits. And it is possible for religious people like fundamentalists to overstep their bounds and saying, I'm letting my religion interfere with my scientific discovery. And it's just as possible for scientific people to overstep their bounds and start to make religious conclusions when they have no means to do so. And it's right for us as Catholics to say, wait a minute, you know, it's kind of like the two kids, you go to your room, you go to your room, right? There's a limit to where your space is. But if we do that, we can then trust them both. We can treat them both as wonderful ways to learn more about this wonderful place that God created for us. And that is my talk. So time for questions, just as a, well, we'll come back to this, I guess. I have what we're doing for next month, and then I also have where the materials can be found for those who want to go grab it. So we'll come back to that after questions. Questions that people have.
I remember seeing something about Sir Isaac Newton, and I cannot remember who was his contemporary, but he actually wrote in his personal diaries that science and religion are one and the same. But he didn't have the courage to say it while he was alive. He left it in his writings because he was afraid of the repercussions that would come through. But I can't remember when.
Yeah,
after Galileo?
No, very much so. He would have been a century or two later. He would have been more of a contemporary, help me out, people who know their science, more of a contemporary of Darwin than of Galileo. Yeah, but yeah, I think that's true from what I understand, that he was one of those scientists who well understood that relationship there. Other questions or comments?
Will this slide set be available?
I'll make. In fact, the link is on the next page, and I'll find a way to link it so that's easy to get to. You don't have to copy down the super long link.
I once heard a story about a car accident, and I don't know if you heard, but there comes policeman, comes a news reporter, comes a medical team, and various kinds of people, and each one from them sees the accident from a different point of view. So that's kind of similar here. We all seeing the truth, whatever, from a different points of view, from medicine, from theology. So they can all be right.
Yeah, that's very true. And by the way, if you have questions for me, maybe beyond the topics, or tangential to the topic, I'm free to answer them as well.
I guess one of the things that I've always wondered. God is all good. God created us. God created the world. Where did evil come from?
Yeah, that's a very big question. And a tough one. The answers to that are often not nearly as satisfying as we would like. The shortest answer to it is free will allows us the opportunity for evil. Our belief is God wanted us to be able to freely choose Him. That made our love much more valuable, right? A slave who has to love their owner because they are bound to them will never have the sort of loving relationship of spouses who freely choose each other. Right, so God wanted to give us free will so that we could freely choose Him. It would make that love that much more powerful. But when He does that, it allows for people to choose evil. And once that happens, you now have evil in the world. Yeah, it's theologically true, but it's tough because it's not... It's like, well, why do people do that? Why do people choose that? You'd think they'd want to choose good. And that answer doesn't necessarily answer that question. That's, I think, an even more difficult question, which, again, goes back to Genesis chapters 2 and chapter 3 are kind of delving into that realm of original sin and this desire to sin, that desire to break away from God that is inherent to humanity. Free will allows us to do it, but our desire to choose it is... somewhat disconcerting. To some degree, the church, I don't think, has a great answer for why we choose it, just accepts that it's truly the reality. And I always say that original sin is the most obvious truth in all of humanity. There is nothing more true than original sin. You just have to look around, read the newspaper, look at yourself. How many times do we say to ourselves, I've said this in homilies, I'm an idiot. Why did I do that? Why did I do that? I knew it was stupid. I knew it was wrong. I did it anyway. I am such an idiot. That's original sin, right? That is what is existing in all of us, that we have this deformed will that we can't do what's right even when we know it's right. Luckily, God helps bring us closer than doing that all the time.
Back here.
A little closer. I think the right way to look at that is, again, it's a question of nature. It's not a question of a set of historical events. So it just is. That's just the nature of humanity. No matter what was the case, that was going to happen. We were going to choose wrong. And so Adam and Eve were not some particular individuals who made a bad choice and were all doomed from that. No, it's just the nature of our humanity. So it could have been you. You could have been involved with Adam and Eve. That could have been your mistake. If you were that first person, you would have done the same thing. Into apple? That's an excellent question. I don't know the etymology of why that, but yeah, there's a lot of that in scripture of it just says fruit. I don't know, maybe that's just the idealistic fruit.
I don't know why
an apple. It's the more I dig into scripture, the more I realize there are things that just aren't stated. Like, how about this? How many wise men are described in scripture? No. That's what we think. We even give them names. It just says wise men showed up. What they came with was three gifts. So you got to hope that if there was a fourth guy there, he felt really stupid, right? I didn't know we were bringing gifts, right? So, I mean, it's not the worst assumption, but nowhere in there does it say three wise men. And we just treat that just like the apple as fact. And maybe it's not a bad assumption, but it is an assumption nevertheless. So yeah, apple... There's no good explanation for apple. Did you have one?
Oh, no.
Okay, looks like you did. Anyone else? Sure.
Okay, so we're going to go and talk about the contact portion of what you mentioned, that saw it movie, and that there's a lot of people out there that believe in contact. or that someday humanity is going to be able to make contact with somebody from somebody else.
Sure.
So I've heard the explanation of that somehow, I can't remember if it was a Pope or somebody else that said that, that's okay if that happens.
Yep.
Because that's just, but the thing is that, you know, when you talk to other people, especially like fundamentalists and stuff like that, they're always, well, no, because, we, you know, we're the only creation in the universe. So how do you see that? You know,
The Catholic Church is absolutely fine with the idea that there are other beings out there. It also is absolutely fine with we're the only ones out there. This is actually one of those that's scientists making a leap of faith. They're just sure there has to be someone else out there. And frankly, I agree with them. But there just has to be someone else out there. The universe is so big, it'd be this huge waste of space. It's just not possible. And there is zero evidence of this whatsoever. None. No evidence. And that's fine. You know, there are plenty of things that we reason ourselves to as Catholics that we don't have evidence for. But the fact that they're ignorant of the fact that it is a belief system is what was as frustrating, you know, to a Catholic, right? No, it's something you believe. There must be out there. And as I said, I agree. There's probably beings out there. And as Catholics, we got no problem with that. That God's creation is this huge, massive thing that had other sentient beings somewhere else. Great. Right? There was this one kind of Catholic online blogger personality that came up with this list of, it was like 8 things that need to happen before it's a problem for us, right? There's intelligent beings out there that they have free will, that they disobeyed God, that they haven't received a Redeemer, that the time for the Redeemer has demonstrably come and gone. You know, this big list of things that would have to be before we would have to say it was a violation of what we believe as people. And you have to go through all of these things, and none of them, well, we can't even find the people first yet, but there's no reason for us to fear that that huge long train of things would be true. But yeah, so I don't know, probably not in my lifetime, but it would be very fascinating to find out something. But you think by this point somebody would have a radio signal out there we would have heard. Another one kind of along those lines, there was a great documentary about the, what is the probe that we sent out past all the planets in the 70s? Voyager, yeah. And the people, you know, because there's this record in there with all of this human stuff on it. The people who did that seemed so convinced that somebody's going to find this speck of dust thrown out into the universe. And I was just, how is that possible? How would anybody find that? Imagine somebody from, you know, 100 light years away throwing a speck in our direction. What's the likelihood we're going to find it when it goes flying by? It could pass nearly inside our atmosphere and we probably wouldn't know about it. Right? So, again, it would be wonderful if it did net something, but it's kind of another one of those things. Inside all of our motivations in life are these very belief, faith-oriented kinds of things, which as Catholics, we embrace. We say that's wonderful. It's just really disappointing when people don't recognize it in themselves. They don't realize that about their own worldview, that it has these strong aspects of belief. Is that a question back there, young lady? Okay. Oh, they've found bones of human beings going back generations, you know, thousands and tens of thousands of years. There was a time when various religious people got upset with the idea that there were other humanoids that besides human beings. But again, as Catholics, we don't find that troublesome. We just, whether they were sentient, whether they were endowed with a soul, all of these things, we don't necessarily know. We have some ideas and thoughts about that. Kind of like the aliens, you know, probably there's no reason to think that they didn't have a soul in those things, but we don't know. You know, we don't think animals have a soul the way human beings do. So perhaps some of those humanoid creatures didn't have a soul. We haven't received any revelation to prove that one way or the other, but their existence doesn't trouble us one way or the other either. But yeah, we have archaeological finds of human beings going back, anybody know what, 20,000, 50,000 years? Long time. Long time, yeah. Great question. Other questions? Oh, okay. So the young people have all the great questions tonight. All right. By the way, what's your name?
Max.
Max. Nice to meet you, Max.
I just wanted to ask, what are your thoughts about scientists only searching 1% of the ocean?
I haven't thought about it, to be honest. It's an interesting question. We've only looked at 1% of the ocean. It probably is more of the ocean than it feels like. You know, there's a lot down there, but just like how many people have actually stepped over every square inch of the Great Plains, that doesn't mean we don't know what's out there. Not much. So it's an interesting thought that, you know, there might be discoveries to be made that we don't know about. I mean, definitely as we've gone deeper, we found these weird fish. Have you ever seen those fish that, like, you bring them up and they just go, like, flat? So, yeah, there may be some stuff out there, but to some degree, I suspect that number is a little bit deceptive and makes it seem smaller than it really is, that exploring 1% of the ocean, statistically, you have a lot more of the ocean than you think. I don't know, but that's just Deacon Ken's opinion, which you're always in trouble when you're down to Deacon Ken's opinion. We're taught in formation, don't share your opinion. You're supposed to share church teaching. Other questions? Yeah, absolutely.
It's just between science and religion.
Yep, you're on, yep.
Well, in science, sometimes there's a proof that we do something unhealthy. We know that's unhealthy, right? But because our faith, they said, oh, I'll pray that, you know, if they get sick, they can be cured. One time, the healing priest said that most of those are not cured because it was, they know that scientifically it's unhealthy and still they eat it or whatever. So sometimes.
Yeah, I do a fair amount of that, eating stuff that isn't healthy for me. I mean, God, part of why God gives us free will is to work on things ourselves, right? That so if we find out that it's unhealthy to eat too many Twinkies, that we should just do the right thing and eat fewer Twinkies, right? So God, when God chooses to interfere with the universe and to say, I'm going to save this person despite the fact that they should have known better, that's a question for God at the end of your life. His decisions are not easy to, you know, completely get our mind around. So he can do it whenever he wants. He doesn't do it a whole lot. And so the smart ones don't rely on it, right? They say, if your two choices are eat fewer Twinkies and pray for God that he'll save you from your Twinkie indulgence, we all know what's the more likely one to bear fruit. And I think God, not just in the health sense, but in the arc of our entire lives, he wants us to participate in goodness, right? Whether that's goodness for our own health, goodness for the world, goodness for our fellow man, goodness for, you know, God's purpose for us on this earth. He wants us to actively participate in those things. So being healthy, I mean, it's an active thing I pray about. I pray about the fact I'm overweight and I should be doing something about it. And what I ask for is not for God to just come chop it off, right? What I ask for is the strength, the fortitude to be more healthy. to turn my life around to do a better job. But yeah, sometimes he saves you anyway. Sometimes he's that nice, and God's blessings to those who are so lucky, right? Other questions? Okay, well, thanks everyone for coming. Let me go back again to the topics for next month. I am very serious about what I said at Mass about wanting feedback from all of you on topics. I want to talk about what you guys want to talk about. I don't want to talk about what interests me. I can do that on my own time. Next month, the topic will be, did God change between the Old and New Testaments? Right? There's this kind of general thought of there's the Christian God and there's that harsh, evil Jewish God who slayed people. And why the difference? Right? So we'll delve into this idea of, did God change? What's the story behind all of this perception of the Jewish God of the Old Testament who, you know, you looked at a woman wrong and you were turned into a pillar of salt, or that's not the quite right story, but you get the idea. And the New Testament Jesus who forgives Peter despite the fact that he abandoned him in his very hour of need, right? What is this reality that or what is this thing that we think we see in Scripture? So we'll talk about that. The date for it will be, it's always going to be the third Tuesday, except for in April when the third Tuesday is Tuesday of Holy Week. And the best way to get shot by the pastor is to schedule something during Holy Week. So I didn't do that. It's the fourth Tuesday that month. But third Tuesday next month is November 20th. Yes, unfortunately, that is Thanksgiving, 2 days before Thanksgiving. We're just going to suck it up because I want consistency. I want to keep it on the same date and not worry about that. So 7:30 right here in the Morris Hall as always. Topic is, did God change between the Old and New Testaments? And as promised, deaconken.org, first thing I did when I was ordained, almost quite literally, it had been like an hour, was go get that domain name. I said, if that's free, I'm taking it. About 20 years ago, Crawford.com was free, and I said, what do I really care? And I beat myself up about it ever since. So when deaconken.org was free, it was like, I'm grabbing it. So deaconken.org is my website, personal website as a deacon. The slide deck, that is the actual link to them. I'll find a way to link them a little bit more easily on the website. So just go to deaconken.org. I do have a horribly updated blog. It's like a month and a half since my last entry. But as you saw, I took video here and here. I'm wearing a mic to have good audio and slides. My hope is to put together a nice video of the whole presentation. That's not going to happen tomorrow, but hopefully in the next few weeks, I'll have that posted on the website, probably on YouTube and then referenced on the website.